is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
To hear the remainder of that beautiful piece of music written by my guest today from Dublin, Ireland, John Kinsella. John, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a great honor to speak to you. Thank you for the invitation.
Great honor to speak to you as one of the foremost composers in Ireland, if not around the world, a composer of 11 symphonies. Many concerti, chamber music, and what we're going to do today, and hopefully this will be the first of several radio interviews you and I do together. We want to introduce our listeners to you as a person, as a composer, and your music. And what they've just heard, John, is the first 3 minutes of your Nocturne for Cello and String Orchestra. Now, would you tell us a little about it? Evidently, this was something that you wrote originally in 1990 and revised much later on.
That's correct. That's correct, Neil. The piece began life as the slow movement of a violin concerto, would you believe, which I wrote for my dear wife, Therese, and she premiered it in Dublin with the National Symphony Orchestra. And she advised me afterwards to actually do a string orchestra arrangement, which I did, and it proved quite popular. And the cello version came about About 10 years ago, I was asked to write a piece for the 60th birthday of a very good friend of mine. And at that stage, I was recovering from a rather lengthy illness, and I didn't have much gas in my tank, as they say. So I suggested making an arrangement of the nocturne for cello. And that's how that particular piece came about.
Well, let's listen to this, the middle of it, and then we'll come back and talk more about it before we play the last part. And I want our listeners to know that John Kinsella's nocturne is being played by the Irish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Anthony Marwood, and Andrew Gourlay is a marvelous cellist. Let's listen to the middle of the nocturne for cello and string orchestra. The composer, John Kinsella, before we listen to the end of that beautiful, beautiful stretch of cello melody, do you ever get tired of hearing something like that that you yourself have written?
Well, it's actually quite nice to hear that. I haven't heard that piece for, I'm sure, a few years now at this stage.
Really?
So it comes as a bit of a surprise. I tend not to listen too much. Now, not for any particular reason, just I don't seem to do that, you know.
It has the touch of inspiration to me, to my ears.
Yes. Well, it certainly did flow, and I know once I got the opening idea, the little kind of rocking motif with which the movement mm-hmm. begins, like a kind of a slow pendulum swinging. Once I got that moving, I think I wrote the whole movement in just a few days. It's one of those unusual pieces which flew without much worry or having to do extra work or revision on it. So it did flow okay. There's another little novelty in that version for cello and strings is that I insert just beyond where we've been listening a little instruction which asks the solo to play a short cadenza of their own writing, you know, to make up a cadenza on the spot. So that's a kind of a novelty which didn't occur in the original version.
Well, let's hear what Mr. Gourlay comes up with, because we're going to listen right now to the remainder of this beautiful nocturne for cello and strings. That was John Kinsella's Nocturne for Cello and String Orchestra. And might I say to the composer, thank you. That is one absolutely gorgeous piece of music.
Thank you, Dale. Thank you very much.
And I mean, it's I predict that in the not-too-distant future, that piece will be being played all over the place by cellist after cellist who... And by the way, Mr. Gourlay has a very fine tone, does he not?
Indeed.
And you approved of how he played it.
Well, it's pretty perfect, all right. Yes, very, very expressive, lovely sound.
And for those who are listening, want to own this recording, it's from an album or a CD entitled Homage to John Kinsella. It's available on iTunes and other places on the internet where you can download music. The CD itself you can find, although it'd be much easier to find the download. And, John, you know, when I programmed this interview, I purposely began with the Nocturne because it is accessible and it does have an immediacy to the listener that you know, a lot of music does not have, and some of your other music does not have. And so what I've done is I've scheduled your Seventh Symphony, one of your great works, for the second half of the show. A little more demanding, a little more demanding. But before we get there, I want to play another piece of music which is accessible, and that is certainly not in any way critical. In fact, I consider it high praise to be both accessible and profound at the same time. This is your Elegy for Strings. Now, how did this composition come about?
Again, Dale, this work was transplanted from another context. It's actually the central movement of my Symphony Number 9, which is for string orchestra, and this was commissioned by the Irish Chamber Orchestra, who initially asked me to write a concerto for string orchestra. And after a lot of thought, I found that wasn't really my way. I didn't want to go down that particular road. So I suggested writing my next symphony for them, which would be Number 9. And they accepted that idea, and I also got the notion at the same time to base the entire symphony on the chorale Jesu meine Freude in two settings by Bach, and I forget the other one, so the entire piece is based on that chorale, the old German chorale. Now, I made a gesture towards their initial request in that I wrote three movements with a coda, but each movement is preceded by a concerto-like recitative or passage. So this elegy, which was initially called Largo in its original context, is preceded by a recitative and followed by a recitative. So, for the purpose of playing it as a standalone piece for this particular recording, I composed a new ending to close it out and let it exist as a piece in its own right. So, that's how this particular piece came into being.
Well, and exist it certainly does. We're going to play this piece in two sections. It's about 6 minutes long, so we're going to listen to the first half. And it goes into what I would call almost a kind of concerto grosso mode. Is that fair to say in the middle of it?
It would be fair to say indeed, yes. And also the mood of the piece is a kind of center of rest in the symphony as a whole, because the two main movements which precede and follow it are very virtuosic.
Well, let's take a listen to the first half of John Kinsella's Elegy for Strings. We're going to come back to the second half of the Elegy for Strings, written in 2011 by John Kinsella. And John, I wanted to ask, since you studied viola yourself as a young man in Dublin, is that one reason you're so partial to these great lush string melodies?
Possibly, indeed. The viola is, a wonderful instrument. I suppose one could say that. As I also mentioned, it's an entire contrast to the rest of the symphony which surrounds it. So it's a moment I was reaching for just complete stillness, which is hints at cadences.
This is the eye of the storm, so to speak?
The eye of the storm, exactly.
The overall mood, when you name something Elegy, do you think that colors how the listener hears it?
I'm sure it does. It's sadness, of course. And I'm sure the name, like the word Elegy itself, is very potent. And I hope it's the music expresses that aspect of what we mean by Elegy.
Well, when we finish listening, I'm going to ask you how this connects to your Irishness. So let's listen to the second half of Elegy for Strings by John Kinsella.
Thank you.
been listening to Elegy for Strings by the man who's on the phone from Dublin, John Kinsella. Now, was that the bass that sort of takes up the theme at the very end there, John?
That's correct, yes, the double basses. The texture keeps changing from solo to section to you know, continuously change the weight of the orchestration.
And so it's so beautiful. So beautiful. And, I mean, is it a silly question to ask you about the connection of your music to being Irish?
I don't see anything particularly Irish in it, do you? I suppose that's maybe for a listener to decide on for themselves. Actually, those two pieces which you played are not really my default mode, if you'd like to put it that way, because I generally tend to write kind of nervous, ongoing music. and with, you know, energetic striving for a goal, you know, that kind of
yes.
reaching out and
we're going to hear that
energy.
Yeah. We're going to hear that in the Seventh Symphony, but even in your more tumultuous mode, you have these moments of great lyricism thrown in.
Yes, I suppose it's part of my nature, all right. It's bound to show through. Kind of melancholy, but surely we all have that to some degree or another.
No, the Irish don't have a monopoly on melancholy.
Okay.
So, right after this short break, we'll be back with John Kinsella, one of our most wonderful living composers. What can I say? We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Dan Dimitay and Patrick Rice, and we are the co-hosts of Encounter Radio, the show that brings you the life-changing encounters of ordinary people that launch them into lives of extraordinary mission. Encounter Radio is a show where the supernatural becomes natural and where you are encouraged and equipped to live out your calling every day in boldness and power. You can now hear Encounter Radio on this Ave Maria station every Sunday at 2 p.m. That's every Sunday at 2 p.m. and online at encounterradio.org.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
What does it take to create a truly joyful family life? It might be easier than you think. Researchers at the University of Illinois found that families who made regular time for simple things like family dinners, a game night, family days, family prayer, and even working together on household chores were much happier and more stable than families that spent their time on other activities in their community and school. In fact, the families that made time for these simple rituals were less likely to have kids with school or emotional problems, or deal with promiscuity or drug and alcohol issues, and the parents had happier marriages and greater life satisfaction to boot. If you want to experience your family life as a gift, take time unwrapping that gift by investing in those simple activities of family life that enable you to get to know one another and stay connected to one another. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is the book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
I'm back with John Kinsella, composer from Ireland, and I failed to mention when I introduced him that in the sort of at the, not mid-career, but a good ways into his career, after he wrote his third string quartet in 1977, he stopped composing for nearly a year and a half because he underwent a kind of self-examination of the kind of music he wanted to compose. Up till then, he had been, I guess we would call it in popular parlance, the atonal school using serial tone rows, is what happened in your life or what happened in your thinking to make you reevaluate and begin to compose in the with the kind of music we heard in the first half of the show?
Well, when I found my feet to some degree with serialism after a lot of searching, I found it quite useful at the beginning because my early studies were not very productive in tone of the harmony and that, and the mode of teaching which I encountered didn't help me an awful lot. So in a peculiar way, to move into serialism and the kind of path that it showed up helped me for a while. And I began to write ever more densely orchestrated pieces, ending with a very large choral orchestral work. But I found that really I'd reached the end of the road with the serialism because tonality was beginning to break through in the last few works, and I realized there was something happening and that the serial way was really counterproductive in the long run. But for a while, it did help me to gain a certain amount of freedom handling notes, if you like. And so I reached that point in, I suppose, 1976. And at the same time, I began writing my third string quartet. And unfortunately, that paralleled the my first wife was actually dying of cancer at the time while I was writing the work. And very shortly after I finished it, she passed away. So for both of those reasons, if you like, for musical reasons and for personal reasons, I had really nothing to say at all until I recovered from that.
Well, I thank you for sharing that. I know that's got to be an emotional memory to share. I notice you didn't even write your first symphony until you were 52 years old in 1984.
Yes, that's correct. I had a few shots at writing symphonies which never saw the light of day, if you like. I was about 17 when I wrote my first symphony, and fortunately, I think the score has now been mislaid somewhere. But I wrote a sinfonietta, and I wrote a symphony for five for a small chamber group. So I've always been fascinated by the idea of symphonies, like from my earliest teen days. I have notes written down in diaries of hearing this symphony and that symphony. So I've been obsessed by the whole idea of symphonies for all of my life that I can remember. So to actually begin writing one was rather daunting. And in fact, I came about it in a rather oblique way in that I wrote an essay for orchestra, which our principal conductor, Albert Rosen at the time, said would make a good first movement for a symphony. So on his bidding, I actually finished it, and it turned into Symphony No. 1. And I haven't stopped writing since.
No, you recently published your 11th symphony,
11,
which has yet to be performed, but we're all working on getting that performed, I can tell you, including our mutual friend Bob Riley, who introduced us, who's been on this show many times and praises you so highly in his book, Surprised by Beauty. We want to move now to your 7th symphony, and we're going to play parts of it. Could you describe it as a symphony in one movement inspired to a certain extent by the 7th Symphony of Sibelius, but yet it is in sections. So how is it, how does all these sections, from your perspective, become a whole?
Yes. The form of the work as I see it is an introductory passage which is repeated, and then we go into the main allegro section, and that has two main ideas, and they rotate, if you like, A and B sections, and after B we come to A1, which is an expanded version of the material in A, and it goes like that, I think, three times, and then we come to the coda.
Now, Sibelius is, you love Mozart, you love Beethoven and Haydn, but Sibelius is really the composer who most inspires you, is that correct?
I would think, I would classify Sibelius as my musical saint, if you like.
Huh.
I feel I have, when I'm listening to Sibelius, I feel I have Nordic blood in my veins.
Well, you've got a bald-headed saint. let's listen to the first part of the first movement, Maestoso. Is that how you say it, John?
Maestoso, yes.
From the Seventh Symphony of John Kinsella. This is the beginning of John Kinsella's Seventh Symphony. This is not the Kinsella of the Elegy or of the Nocturne. This is the Kinsella who is muscular, who is turbulent, who, as he said, is searching, seeking, sort of shaking his fist. I don't know what God or the world or what. But, you know, with those very dramatic chordal punctuations, Beethoven comes to mind more than anyone else, John, to me.
Yes, Steele, another one of my musical gods, if you like. What I'm trying to do in the symphony as a whole is kind of moving from chaos to peace, if you like. And it's a 25-minute road we follow. So that's my kind of opening dramatic statement, which... Underneath that, you'll hear a kind of ostinato on the cellos and double basses, who are playing from a B to a C, to a B to a C, to a B to a C. And ultimately, as with the Sibelius Seventh Symphony, the resolution at the end is brings us back to C major again.
And we're going to hear a wordless chorus come in the very last movement. But for right now, let's listen to part of the second movement of the Seventh Symphony of John Kinsella.
Thank you.
That was the beginning of the second section of what is considered a single movement symphony, the Seventh Symphony of John Kinsel. And now, John, I noticed there toward the end of what we just heard, these strings emerge with a very, hopeful melody, kind of upward-looking melody, which keeps me as a listener connected to where you're taking me.
Yes, I think, Dean, that listening to it there now, it's, I suppose, part of the human condition. You know, we're always striving for peace and closure on certain things and reaching out for it. So that particular passage, I suppose, might express that.
It's almost as if the clouds parted there for a moment, the sun came through.
Yes, yes, after all the striving through the thickets and that.
Well, one thing I want to make sure we do is preserve enough time to play the last movement last section of this Seventh Symphony in its totality. So let's go ahead and move to what I believe I'm offering here is the latter part of the third section of your Seventh Symphony. Let's take a listen. Your affection for Jan Sibelius certainly came through in that section from your Seventh Symphony, again marked, like the first part, Maestoso. Was I right in hearing something close to a Sibelius quotation in there?
Yes, indeed, Deal. Not exactly a quotation, but the prominent use of the solo trombone, which, as you know, has one of those magnificent three times it appears in the Sibelius Seventh Symphony, this wonderful solo trombone theme. And there's also in my seventh, there's an offstage trombone appears from time to time, which is like an echo of the orchestral trombone itself. So adding another dimension, if you like, to that particular sound.
Mm-hmm. In spite of your opinion of Mahler, but we won't go into that. We're gonna move on to the fourth section, an allegro section, a second allegro section of John Kinsel's Seventh Symphony. is ground. You know, John, I'm a big fan of Sibelius's Seventh Symphony. I've always felt that that symphony kind of tumbled from high up on a mountain downward. This symphony, your Seventh, feels more like you're going up a mountain.
Well, I suppose I naturally have a different view on the Sibelius, you know, because it strikes me as one of the most extraordinary inventions. And, like, there's a passage at the end, just towards the final denouement, if you like, at the Sibelius 7, there's this wonderful theme for flute and a bassoon, which is like a bit of plain chant.
Yes.
And it's one of the most peaceful moments in music before his final resolution.
Well, let's listen to the let's listen to a section of your fifth part of the Seventh Symphony, again marked Maestoso. John Kinstler, when those horns came in right there, I felt a very strong sense of resolution. Is that what you intended?
Yeah, we're coming towards that deal, certainly, yes.
They're very clear, they're very tonal, they're almost as if saying, we've almost arrived at our destination.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Well, speaking of the destination, I want to go ahead and play the entirety of the last section marked epilogue of your Seventh Symphony, and it'll give us a little while to discuss it afterward. Let's listen. the Seventh Symphony of John Kinsella, who's on the phone with us from Dublin. John, a lot of artists have trouble with endings, but clearly, from what we just heard, you do not.
It is a problem deal, all right. And in that particular case, it wasn't too difficult because, like, I had the program, you know, from Chaos to Peace in my mind, and also linked up with the resolution of the C major. And I was asked to incorporate into the work a choir, and I use it as an offstage chorus. So, like, if you like, the debate on the final resolution of C major using the offstage chorus kind of moves the thing beyond the earth itself, if you like. And C major is resolving out in the universe.
Well, it has
endless peace.
It has a magical effect, just a magical effect. And it does, in fact, bring us not only to the end of your symphony, but to the end of our hour together. Again, for our listeners, John Kinsella's music is available on CD and downloads. This two CDs that we played today, the homage to Kinsella, and this particular Seventh Symphony was played by the National Symphony Orchestra of Ireland, conducted by, and you'll have to pronounce it for me, John.
Pronfis O'Din?
Yes, Pronfis O'Din. And I hope...
That's an Irish version of... The English version of Pronfis O'Din would be actually Francis Dunn.
Well, that makes it a lot easier.
So it sounds more
for next time.
Yes.
Well, I look forward to having you with us again on Church and Culture to play some more of your music and to get to know you better. And we want to thank you very much for joining us today from Dublin.
Thank you very much, Steele. It's been a great pleasure and honor for me, as I say. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And all of you are listening, please hang on. We'll have a short break and come back with another wonderful guest.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
The Bible illustrates God's relationship with us as a bridegroom with his bride, and this prompts us to consider what that means. The prophets described God as the groom and said he would seek out his bride when she wandered away. Do we hear God calling to us when we wander away? Song of Songs is about two lovers, often interpreted as the story of the soul with God. Do we believe that God cares for us that intimately? Jesus uses parables to describe himself as the bridegroom, and Paul speaks of the church as Jesus' bride. Do we see ourselves loved by a groom who will sacrifice his life for us? In Revelation, the bridal imagery culminates in heaven with the marriage banquet of the Lamb with his bride. Do we look forward to that celebration as we prepare for it now on earth? To learn more about the meaning of imagery in Scripture, visit the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan at cbsmich.org.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Can you pick your children's friends? Some degree, I hope so. Who says you can't pick their friends? I know they do. But what do you say? Would you allow your 9-year-old to watch an R-rated movie? How about the basic afternoon TV talk show fare? Would you let him leaf through an adult magazine? Can he go to a birthday party with no adult supervision? Most likely your answers are no, 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 and no. Why? Because you know that one of your prime parental duties is to protect, to shield your child from risk and harm, physical or emotional. If you're like most parents, you are more confident monitoring these impersonal influences, media, movies, video games. You get a little more unsure of yourself when the influence is personal, that is, another child. Any child whose innocence is fast eroding, through association, may wash away some of your child's still childlike innocence. My belief? It's every bit as important to distance your children from worldly people, however young, as it is from worldly things. Where character formation and peer relations clash, always choose in favor of character. I'm Dr. Ray.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. May 13th is the joyful feast of Our Lady of Fatima. You will recall that when she spoke to the children, she warned that without conversion, Russia would spread its errors throughout the world, leading to the annihilation of nations. That was in 1917. 3 years later, Russia first legalized abortion, and that error has indeed spread worldwide and has annihilated entire nations, because the numbers of children killed around the world by abortion every year is 50 million. When we hear prophecies saying that nations will be destroyed, that doesn't mean it has to happen all at once, nor does it have to happen by a nuclear bomb. Will there be a chastisement of the world? It seems clear to me that there has already been one of major proportions, and it is called abortion. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
One of my favorite things to do is to enjoy the silence. They say God's voice is the loudest in the silence, but I don't always get that opportunity in my life to turn off the noise and just be in silence with God. Someone once recommended that I spend this daily time meditating on